So let's just jump right in and talk about you and Brahms and this new recording. Tell us a little bit about the genesis of it. It's been a while in the making. Can you tell us how it came to be and how you ended up going with the London Symphony?
Yes, I played the piece for many, many years and have had the privilege of playing it with many different orchestras, wonderful different orchestras and conductors. And the opportunity came up through Decca to record the second concerto. And so, you know, the London Symphony is sort of a master of doing these kinds of projects. They have the, you know, Abbey Road Studios, which is very convenient, right in the heart of London. And so it was just, you know, the wheels were oiled and ready to go, so to speak. So yeah, all we had to do is find a time and a good piano. And
that's always important, I imagine.
Yeah. And so, you know, I'm sort of at a stage in my life, you know, where I teach it at the Jacobs School of Music at Indiana University, which I love. And when you teach music like this, it's nice to be able to show your students that, well, here's my attempt at it. So, but it's also, you know, on a much more deeper level, it also is one of my favorite pieces. It's one of the greatest works of music ever written, and one of the most challenging to play.
Yeah, you talk about it as climbing Mount Everest, as it were.
Yeah, there is that analogy. I think also there is the, hopefully after one works out many aspects of it, that you're sort of floating over Mount Everest and looking yeah, down, you know, at the horizon and the panorama, etc.
It's kind of like the runner's high, I guess, when you kind of reach that point.
I think so, yes, yeah, especially the second and third movement of the concerto.
I want to talk a little bit about your approach to Brahms. I hear it especially in this concerto. There are so many different emotions wrapped up in this concerto, and you hear it right away, back and forth. There's kind of the humility of Brahms, the authenticity of Brahms, and then there's the heroic, passionate side. And I think you really play into both of those sides of Brahms really well. It really comes out, and I wonder if that's a conscious thing on your part or if it's just a matter of feeling.
It's both, actually. I think you really identified, you know, the primary important parts. Yes, it's a struggle, but it's also very rewarding. And there's that additional element, which is the spirituality of the music. I remember when I was very young, conductor saying he was conducting a youth orchestra and they were doing a Brahms symphony. And at one point, he got really, really excited and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, just do what he wrote. He knew what he was doing. You see, this is God's music." Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, he hit it on the head, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, and especially with this concerto, it's about as close as you can get, I think, when it goes well, to experiencing a transcendental sort of feeling,
yeah,
you know, where you're really being a vessel to serve the composer.
Well, and as a listener, you know, you're taking us along for the ride, which is nice.
Right, right.
Yeah. Now, you've recorded the first piano concerto. That was a live recording, I believe, right?
Yes, yes, with Joanne Folletta and the Virginia Symphony.
And I imagine, I mean, aside from the fact that they're very different from each other, I imagine the process was different for you preparing for an in-studio recording as opposed to that live recording?
Yes and no. I mean, I will say that when we recorded the first concerto, of course, there were, you know, two performances, live performances.
Mm-hmm.
So editing was not really possible. I mean, if there was some editing, it was more dealing with acoustical balance, etc. In the second concerto, I will say that we took very large takes. In the first movement in particular, I think the second take was a take from beginning to end. And so you're not hearing, you know, slicing and dicing, so to speak, you know, of what right. they can do with digital technology. These are large sweeps of where we really were playing. It was like chamber music.
Right.
And so I'm very
right.
happy about that. And I think, the further I get away from the recording, and whenever I hear little bits and pieces of it, the happier I am, because it sounds very natural, as it should. It shouldn't sound, you know...
manufactured.
Yeah.
You say that you've known this concerto for a long time. What's your history with Brahms? I know you grew up on the West Coast, right?
Yes.
In a musical family.
Yes.
You told a great story in one video about when you were 7, I think, when you decided that you had to be a musician or a pianist. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes. Well, you know, my mom took me to hear Jascha Heifetz, and I didn't know who Jascha Heifetz was. And that changed my life forever. I mean, I heard the sound that he got out of the violin. It went through me like an X-ray. And then it was almost like a light bulb was turned on.
Were you playing piano at that point already?
Yeah, I was studying the piano. I'd also studied the violin mm-hmm. and the clarinet. But I liked the fact that I could play on the piano. You can play 10 notes at once. And not take responsibility for intonation. So that was very appealing to me. But it also suited my personality. I love harmony. And I love, the different sonorities that one can create on the piano. Mm-hmm. The only thing I must confess that I miss, is on the piano you can't make a crescendo or get louder on one note. You have to create the illusion of doing that.
Yeah, but that's even more of a challenge,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
I've heard you talk about voicing and fingering and how, like, the weak part of the hand is often given the strongest part of the phrase.
Right.
I think it's fascinating to... these are things that people don't necessarily think about when they listen to a recording like this.
Mm.
All of the... literally the orchestration that goes into it with your 10 fingers.
Right. Well, I always like to think of it as 10 singers, not 10 fingers.
Oh, yeah.
Because Brahms, to me, is a choir composer, meaning that he writes chorally for symphonies and also pianists and chamber music. It's basically, you know, the working through of harmonies in a very chorale-like way. So the hand, the physiology of the pianist's hand is that, you know, our strongest melodies are usually in the soprano, parts of the right hand, which are the fourth and fifth fingers, and those are the weakest fingers.
Yeah.
So we can't have our thumbs dominate the sopranos. I mean, that would be would sound unbalanced.
Right.
And so, you know, with Brahms in particular, voicing, layering, texturing, it's a combination of oil painting and pastel at the same time, with the gold frame around the painting, if you know what I mean. I mean, it's
yeah.
just it's royal kind of sonorities that one seeks to try to achieve and express. Yeah. I mean, there is a gruffness, you know, to Brahms that is also very important to have. But the second piano concerto, it's very different. It's much more refined. I mean, he's really, you know, sharpened all of his composing techniques at that stage, and so. Everybody that plays in the orchestra and the pianist, we have to think of the highest level of expression. You know, what kind of forte, what kind of piano, what kind of mezzo, or in his case, poco forte, you know?
Yeah.
What kind of pedaling do you use? You know, how do you shape phrases, etc.? It's a constant... it's like, you know, if you were working on a kiln trying to shape clay, you know, it would just never end because there were endless possibilities of how to
right.
form the design that you want. And I think Brahms gives us that opportunity.
I want to talk a little bit about that first piano sonata, because even though it was written... you know, when he was very young,
mm-hmm.
I think maybe 20 years old or whatever.
Right.
It still has this sense of trying to fit a symphony into those 10 fingers.
Absolutely.
You know, can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the opening measure is a direct quote from the Hammerklavier of Beethoven.
Mm.
And, of course, you know, in that particular work, Beethoven was really literally, I mean, you could imagine the piano being a mini orchestra. And Brahms does the same thing with all his, with all three of his sonatas. They are orchestrated. I mean, one has to, one cannot just be satisfied with a piano sound as a performer. I think it's so helpful to know internally or conceptually that you're imitating clarinets, that you're imitating timpani, that you're imitating horns, that, you know, when you touch the key, that it should, you know, it should emulate a flute or some kind of orchestral touch and sound, and also the embouchures, you know, and the bowings, the string players start a phrase, how they use the bow, how they end on a note. I mean, these are all things I think that can come into play in a sonata like that, where you really emulate different ways of creating sound. Not
and
just
kind of like the dynamics, you have to create the illusion of that sound.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. It's so interesting. Now, I've always thought when you look at two pieces like this put together, paired on one CD, a later work, a masterwork, and then an early work, I mean, there has to be a reason for that. But I'm wondering, sure, you can see there are differences between the two, but what are the similarities between, you know, Brahms in the 1850s and Brahms in the 1880s that you're seeing on paper?
Well, you know, that's a very, very interesting question, and I think it's a profound question because, you know, in reality, if you look at Brahms's music from the early period to his late period, his style of composition really did not change that much, you know? And so there is a thread that goes, I think, throughout all of his compositions, including, you know, the chamber, the music for strings, the clarinet, the symphonies. You can always identify, that's the way Brahms would write that phrase, or there's something harmonically. The fact that he didn't like to write sections with the tonic of the key that he was playing, and he would like to start on the, you know, the dominant of the chord, or the subdominant, you know. So there's certain idiosyncratic qualities that are, you know, constant throughout his life. But as he grew and as he developed, of course, you can tell, you know, that the later works in particular are just absolutely perfect. You know, but even his earlier works, you know, he was so particular, and so, you know, he threw out and destroyed things that he felt didn't represent his best efforts. But even in the first sonata, I mean, you get this exuberance, you know, of youth and the influences of Beethoven and Bach with counterpoint and polyphony that I find very invigorating and very challenging to play. I just played the first sonata twice in the last week on a recital program, and I must tell you, it takes a lot of energy and a lot of strength. I mean, but that's true of everything the Brahms wrote.
Yeah. Well, I think the two pieces complement each other nicely.
Oh, I'm glad you think so.
Wonderful performances on both accounts. The album is from Decca Records, music of Johannes Brahms, Piano Concerto No. 2, along with the Piano Sonata No. 1 from pianist Norman Krieger. Thanks so much for joining us and talking about this recording here on FM 91.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.